Myself a Phoenix. Copyright 2022 John C. Nash. NASHJC@ncf.ca. 18 Spyglass Ridge. Ottawa, Ontario, K2S1R6, Canada. Capsule comment. You only live once is a well-worn phrase, and usually true. Except a few souls, out of a mix of desperation and courage, and willing to take risks in a time of chaos, sometimes get to live more than one life. The difficulty, of course, is that the transformation is built on secrets and lies, and finding the resources to do the reconstruction is fraught with problems. Doing so in wartime gives a means to destroy the old life, but the new one is then complicated by regulations, rationing, and even romance. Preamble. Myself a Phoenix is a work of fiction. While certain historical persons may appear, the main characters and their speech and actions are fictitious. The work was inspired by consideration of a character in the book Christmas with the Railway Girls by Maisie Thomas. Colette, like Mary Smith, escapes an abusive husband by means of hostile bombings in World War II. I wondered, in particular, about the details of how one could create and, more importantly, sustain a new identity in a period of heightened security against foreign agents, of government-operated rationing, and centralized registration for national service. It is certain I have got some details wrong, and I would very much like to know of such cases. Please contact me at the email below if you have information that would be pertinent. I welcome any and all exchanges as long as they are courteous. In my digging, I found one mention that the national identity card did not usually contain a photo unless the holder had some official position. Ms. Thomas suggests a photo was needed, and I would have expected that also. It may be that a photo was required for registration but not attached to the identity card. That I could not determine. Such are the details that are the concern when trying to fabricate a plausible means for someone to become a new person. Because the main thrust of this effort is dealing with such details, the usual preoccupation of a novel in the form of plot and character may be less pronounced. A future rewrite may be in order, depending on how this work is received. John Nash, Ottawa, 2022 NASHJC@ncf.ca. Cover image. https://commons.wikimedia.org/wiki/file:phoenix-fablewisen.jpg. Which is declared public domain. Part 001. You could say I was reborn with a bang. That bang was the explosion of a parachute mine in a street not too far from the British Museum, which also got hit that night. I was on the roof of a modest office building firewatching with another woman named Sheila. We had a jury-rigged firewatcher's hut on the street side of the roof, which faced more or less east, and that was the direction from which we could see the German aeroplanes were coming in. Some had already passed over before letting loose their horrid loads, but others we could see still coming in the bright moonlight. In the middle of everything, I needed to pee. Oh. Got to go. Be right back, I said. There wasn't a lavatory on the roof, of course. We just had a bucket, which we'd put between two large metal boxes that had some sort of equipment for something or other like ventilation or a dumbwaiter. The boxes were about 3 feet high and wide and 6 long, with a couple of feet between. So provided a bit of modesty. I suppose we could have put the bucket in the brick box that was the top of the stairwell. If we had, I wouldn't be here probably. I just relieved myself and was pulling up my knickers and 2 pairs of pants, for the warmth I always had double when firewatching, when I heard Sheila yell parachute mine. Looking towards the front of the building, I could see the parachute drifting down towards us, a few hundred feet up. I saw Sheila duck below the parapet of the roof. I knelt down between the metal boxes. My foot nudged the bucket, and I moved it out onto the roof so I wouldn't kick it over and get piss on myself. silly thoughts in the circumstances. There was an almighty bang, and I think I blacked out for a few seconds. When I came to, I was squashed between the metal boxes. I pushed and they moved enough that I could scramble up. When I looked towards the front of the building, it wasn't there. The front half of the building was gone. In fact, in front of the metal box nearest that side of the building was about 2 feet of roof, then a gaping hole. The pee bucket had disappeared, as had a lot of the parapet, even at the back. How was I going to get down? Maybe the fire escape was still there. It ran down the back of the building, with a swing-down ladder for the last story. I eased myself to the edge of the roof on hands and knees. There was broken brick everywhere. The parapet had been damaged. As I peeked over the edge, I saw the fire escape was still there. Hopefully strong enough to take my weight. There was something I needed to think about. What? Oh yes. Check that I had my gas mask and my raincoat and my handbag. I had been wearing my coat and had my handbag on a long strap over my shoulder. The coat I'd set next to me by one of the metal boxes, and I'd been on it when the mine went off. My gas mask had been in the make-do shelter. Have to arrange to get another. I looked out to the west. There were several fires. A big explosion, another parachute mine, about a mile away. The Germans had a surplus of naval mines now that the Admiralty had apparently found a way to stop them exploding under ships. Hush hush, apparently, but William claimed he knew all about it. My husband. A pompous ass who'd fooled me into thinking he would look after me. Well, not anymore. I put on the coat and buttoned it so it wouldn't get in the way if I had to climb down. Made sure my handbag, fortunately a small, rather flat one, was in a good position a bit to the rear of one hip, then gingerly tested the fire escape. It seemed solid enough and I started down. Noises on the other side of the building suggested bits were falling or that there was a fire, or both. When I got down to the first floor, I saw that the steps were on a hinge. I'd have to move onto them to have them swing down. Stepping out 2 steps, nothing happened. I went further. Nothing. When I got out about halfway, it was still horizontal. Had it jammed? I went 2 more steps. Now I was 3/4 of the way out. I tried a little hop and there was a grinding noise and the steps moved a few inches. I tried again, and suddenly the steps swung down quite quickly. I gripped the railing for dear life. There must have been some sort of rope or cable that meant the steps did not swing down totally freely, but I still got thrown to the ground, which took the wind out of me. I was in an alleyway behind the building. Better get out of here fast. There was rubble everywhere and I had to climb over some piles to get round to the street. As I climbed one, I realized I still had my tin hat on. I took it off, found a brick and made a big dent in the crown of the tin helmet, then threw it hard at the second story of the building on the side of the alley opposite the building I'd been on. The helmet had my name in it. When I got to the end of the alley and round to the street, some rescue workers were coming to investigate the building I'd been on top of. I pressed myself into a doorway, a broken-down doorway because of the blast, but I was in the shadows of the light of a couple of fires, and the rescuers didn't seem to notice me. The firewatcher's shelter must have had a direct hit from that landmine, one of them said. Yes. More likely we can help someone back at number 22, said another, and they moved away from me up the street. Keeping to the shadows, I made my way westward. I wanted to find a wrecked building I could claim I was bombed out of. Then I could be Mary Smith rather than the name I'd had from birth. Part 002. The mine had exploded around midnight. It was near 1 a.m. when I got to the site of the second parachute mine I'd seen explode. There were some ARP and other workers looking at the crater and ruins of a whole row of buildings. It's a bad one, someone said. Jones Ironmongers and that newsagent and the greengrocers. Each of them had living quarters above. I'd noticed the street name, Hollyhock Road, and there were the numbers of the houses painted on the pavement. That was in case the buildings were down, along with their number plates. Number 39 had a spilled bucket of nails. Must have been Jones Ironmongers. I made a note. Two rescue workers were laying out a body and covering it. Two more dead still there, one said to an ARP man. Try next door in case someone survived, was the reply. Good, well, good for me, as I now had my story. I approached the ARP man and asked, is there a rest center near here? Miss, you shouldn't be out. And you're cut on the face. I hadn't noticed. Must have been some flying debris. When I looked at my left hand, there were a number of small cuts there too. Sorry, I went in a shelter down the road, but that place took a hit, though somehow I got out. Supposed to start working here in the Ironmongers tomorrow, and the people running it said I could sleep here for a few nights while I tried to find somewhere to live. I was nearly killed by a bomb just after Christmas. Then a mine went off and I must have been knocked out for a bit, then I came looking for the shop, and it's gone too. These were lies, but plausible ones. And I made my voice slightly hysterical. There's a rest center, if it's still there, up at the church. About half a mile. Turn right at the end of this road. Good luck. I know you're probably in shock, but we can't spare anyone just now to take you. As I followed the directions the ARP man had given, I realized I still had my proper identity card in my handbag. I slipped behind the wall of a garden and sat on the ground and got it out. In the moonlight I could see my name, my real name. I slipped the identity card in my pocket. I took out my Swiss Army knife, a valued and useful present from a young admirer when I was in my last year of school, and gently cut the lining of the handbag and got out the new identity card. The address was Lavinia's. Wedding and engagement rings. I eased them off. Good job I could. I slipped them in the lining of my handbag. Now to get rid of my own card. There was a hut for the ARP up the road, but it looked like the occupants were attending to a damaged house 100 yards away. Anybody here? I asked loudly. No answer. I poked my head into the doorway. There was a small brazier under a kettle that was steaming gently, with a crude metal chimney to allow smoke to exhaust. I looked over my shoulder, then pushed my identity card into the coals and watched it burn while keeping a weather eye for anyone returning. Someone saw me and started to come. Am I going the right way for the rest center? I yelled. Yes. Just up the road about 300 yards, came the reply. Thanks. Shall I take your kettle off the fire so it doesn't boil dry? Please. We're rather busy here. This gave me an opportunity to check my identity card was fully consumed. I was careful to find a rag to use to pick up the kettle and put it on the ground. Then I quietly left and walked up to the rest center. Part 003. There were a lot of people in the church crypt where the rest center had been set up by the WVS. My story of being in a bombing in December and again tonight, and apparently the demise of my new employers, was accepted with a kind but familiar disinterest. I'm afraid we're a bit pressed for accommodation. There may be some bits and pieces of clothing over there with Mrs. Hodges, and do get a cup of tea and a sandwich.
Oh.
We'd better take a look at your cuts. Mrs. Appleby used to be a nurse and is now in the first aid. I got my cuts cleaned and bandaged. My left cheek had sticky plaster holding a gauze dressing that almost obscured half my face. Good. I would be less recognizable as my old self. They gave me another gas mask when I said mine had been blown away somehow, but they did note the serial number and that it was given to Mary Smith. Gas masks could be used to identify people killed. Probably my old one would serve to declare me dead. Tea and a sandwich were definitely a boost to my morale. And Mrs. Hodges found me a headscarf and some unmatched but serviceable gloves, which would protect my left hand. Also a pillowcase I could use to carry what few things I might acquire. I saw a rather torn men's shirt without a collar. The cloth was decent quality and the rips were fixable. "Might I have that?" I asked. "I have a needle and thread in my handbag." I didn't mention a pair of scissors. Small, not much bigger than nail scissors. Designed for fine sewing. Very useful, as was the Swiss Army knife. Mrs. Hodges said, "Why not? It needs some work anyway." I realized my torch was gone. Must have lost it in the blast. After finishing my tea, I went to the lavatory where I checked that there were £30 in the lining of the handbag. I had another £20 sewn into my raincoat. All the money was in £1 or 10 shilling notes. And I had quite a lot of coin in my small purse and a couple of pockets, about 25 shillings in all. It would last a little while, but I'd need to find a job and a place to live. I carefully checked what possessions I had. The lining of my small handbag was still open, but wouldn't show when the flap top was closed. I took a couple of pennies out of my small purse and put them in my trouser pocket, the outer trousers. Ooh. I'd be hot. I thought of taking off the inner trousers and putting them and the shirt in the pillowcase before I left the toilet cubicle. Then I figured I might be waiting a while in a draft and decided to leave them on for now. I had a small notepad and pencil too, and noted 39, Hollyhock Road. And Jones Ironmongers. I might need to give that information, and getting things right would avoid queries. I had my needle and thread and scissors. And my Swiss Army knife. Oh! A pair of clean knickers. Always kept a spare pair in my handbag. I had a fairly sturdy blouse and a good pullover, and a raincoat, though the latter was quite disreputable at the moment. It was now 3:30. Not much I could do for a while, or was there? I went back to the lady who seemed to be in charge. "It's Miss Smith, isn't it? Joan, I recall. She had a good memory. Was that a good or bad thing for me?" "Yes, except I'm called Mary, my middle name. Rather common, I'm afraid." "What can I do for you?" "You said things were difficult here. I've got a little money that somehow stayed with me, enough that I could try to get somewhere that has a better chance of accommodation. And hopefully a new job. Maybe in Oxfordshire or Gloucestershire. I've even thought of joining the Land Army. Do you think I should just go there and see? With all this mess from the bombs, what you suggest might be as good as anything. But don't you have any family?" I already knew that Joan Smith, as she'd been known, had no known family, and gave this information to the lady as if it were my own. It wasn't far from the truth. Then I asked how far it was to Paddington Station. I decided to take the first train. Not, however, to the destinations I'd mentioned, but to Taunton in Somerset. I don't know why that was my choice. The lady said, "It's a couple of miles. I'll draw you a map on the back of this label." The label was one that had been tied to a bomb victim. There was a smear, probably blood, on the front where there was an eye. Internal injury. Probably didn't make it. It was a slow walk to Paddington. I had to detour once or twice and got off track, but luckily stumbled onto Praed Street and found my way, getting there about 5 in the morning. There would apparently be a train at around 6. I bought a ticket. Nothing was open. I'd be hungry when I got to Taunton. Part 004. Perhaps I should enlighten you on why I'm now Mary Smith. I won't tell you my real name, but I will say I was born on the day of the armistice. November 11, 1918. Joan Mary Smith was born December 10, 1917. Her father was already dead, killed at Cambrai that November. In early 1919, her mother and grandmother succumbed to influenza, and Joan was looked after by nuns in a Catholic convent of some sort. As far as I know, it wasn't a formal orphanage. A loose end in my new story, and I didn't know the name or address of it. My parents also died in the flu, but my grandmother looked after me until 1930, when she died and I was taken in by a neighbor who had several children under 5.
Work for bed and board.
I stayed there for a year or so until I was 14, then got out and went to work in an office, adding up the wages for workers in a factory. When I was 18, I got to know William. He was a bank clerk, though he made it seem he was the assistant manager. He was 30 then, and convinced me he could look after me, and we got married. Only his mother and an acquaintance of mine from work at the registry office.
More fool me.
Before we married, he was very sweet. Trouble was, afterwards he wanted total control of my life, my behavior, even my thinking. If I didn't play along, he got nasty. Said I was just a girl and didn't understand life. Only a few times violent, but one of those was heard by our neighbor Lavinia Carter. The walls between the houses were thin. William didn't like me working, but it turned out his tastes outran his wages. He wasn't really a very good bank clerk. I noticed his mental arithmetic was sloppy. After all, I had to do lots of calculations for the wages. Working turned out to be my salvation, because my employers were obliged to provide fire watchers. That's how I came to be on the roof with Sheila. Nice woman. Pity. She had 2 kiddies. I'd like to be able to send my condolences. Lavinia and I liked to garden, and we'd converted every bit of space we could to vegetables. Our victory garden. William was temporarily excused military service, as he'd spent 2 years in a sanatorium for TB starting when he was 19. Apparently he might have to serve eventually in the UK in some non-combat role, but for now his status was deferred. Still, his manager, the one he wasn't assistant to, hinted strongly that everyone must do their bit, and he joined the ARP. It suited him to be able to boss people around, but he didn't get to boss any of the other ARP men and women, which vexed him. In January, when I was clearing up the garden for the coming year, Lavinia said, "I don't think much of a man who hits his wife."
"How did you know?" I asked.
"Heard you the other night. And it's not just the smacks, is it?"
"No.
He wants everything just so, and always how he wants things."
"Have you thought of leaving?"
"He controls all the money, though I've managed to put about £10 aside and hide it. But I think he'd come after me, and if I leave, I want nothing to do with him."
"You could change your name," Lavinia suggested.
"How could I do that? I'd have to get a solicitor and all that, and William would find out."
"No chance you're in the family way, is there?"
"William's mother told me he had mumps when he was about 14. He wants kids, but I don't think he can." "Well, I'll tell you something, but I'll only say it once, because this week the doctor told me I've a cancer and won't be long for this world."
"Oh no. That's terrible, Lavinia."
"Don't fret yourself. I've had a good 60 years. Had a good husband, but lost our boy in the Great War. But there's something I can do for you, and if you're game, I will." I said nothing, but nodded for her to continue. Truthfully, tears were running down my cheeks. I liked Lavinia. She was a good friend. "You may remember Joan. Came here as a lodger in 1937. Like you, she was an orphan and had been in an orphanage. Well, some nuns in a convent looked after her. I don't think it was really an orphanage. Anyway, you know she came a cropper in that raid December 29th. Visiting a friend and took a direct hit. Only a few rags of her clothing, but one bit had a name label."
"Yes. I remember how ghastly that was."
"Well, it happens I've her birth certificate and a letter of recommendation from a Mrs. Chatterton who had owned a laundry where she'd worked and a couple of other bits and bobs. Even her ration book, but best I don't mess with that. Still, you and I could go together and get you a new identity card. Then you can wait for a nice big bomb and arrange to disappear. I looked up the place Joan was killed and found out the name of the girl she was with, Jane Willis.
told Nacors I wanted to know where they were buried so I could pay my respects. People are less suspicious of old ladies. They're in Brookwood. You know. London necropolis. Apparently together because the few bits that were found weren't distinguishable. Part 005. That's what we did. Told a local National Registration officer my handbag had been lost in the bomb and two girls killed. I'd decided there'd be a third girl with us. Doris. Imaginary, of course. Lavinia gave me £40. She said she wasn't going to need it, and indeed by last week, she was looking pretty ill. The doctors said it would be a miracle if she saw the summer this year. That made me terribly sad, but she insisted I told William nothing. We hid the documents and money as I've described above. As I sat on a bench near the Taunton platform at Paddington, I realized I should let her know I'd escaped. I had a couple of blank postcards pre-stamped in my handbag. The post office had been advertising to use them to let people know you were all right after a raid or other things like that. Or, since there were several deliveries a day, you could post one in the morning if you knew you'd be late for tea. I only had a pencil. It would have to do. And I didn't want to use my handwriting, so I printed Lavinia's name and address with my left hand. It looked like a child had written it. The message was simple. Thank you, Mary. I saw a pillar box and posted it. Part 006. I was lucky enough to get a seat on the Taunton train. And an end seat, though on the corridor rather than the window. Still, I was able to sleep. I kept my coat on, with my handbag under it. Getting robbed now would be the last straw. There were delays, of course, and I didn't get to Taunton until noon. I was going to go straight to the Labour Exchange and see if I could get a job of some sort. The Land Army wasn't a bad idea, but I doubted I could get in right away. But maybe there were farms needing help who would take me on. It was spring, and no doubt lots of work needed doing. There'd been some newspaper stories about farm workers joining up and the farmers having trouble finding help. Hence the Women's Land Army, like in the Great War. For a few minutes I reviewed what I knew, and would have to remember, about Mary Smith, well Joan Smith as was. She'd left the convent at age 15 in early 1933 and had gone to work in Mrs. Chatterton's laundry somewhere in the East End. If anyone asked, I'd say it closed down, which it may have done. In 1937, Joan took a job in a British home stores as a sales assistant. That's when she moved to Mrs. Carter's as a lodger. From what Lavinia told me, she'd apparently had a boyfriend who was missing, believed dead, after Dunkirk. Lavinia told me his name was Leonard, but she wasn't sure of his last name, but might have been Curtis. I decided he would be Leonard Curtis, and if there were queries, I could say it was often misspelled, because it was originally Cortez after a Spanish great-grandfather, or perhaps Curtis with two SS. But I hoped there'd be no questions. I would have to be ready with a flood of tears and please don't ask. In any event, Joan had been rather plain-looking and wore spectacles. Fortunately not ugly, since I was considered to be somewhat pretty. But both of us were largely unremarkable, and probably either could pass as the other to a casual onlooker if we were dressed alike and had similar hairdos. Still, I could find some low-power glasses to provide a bit of a cover if ever I needed it. However, I was planning to use Mary, not Joan, as the name I'd be called by. As I got off the train, I realized that I'd forgotten it was Sunday morning. Damn. That would mean I'd have to find a place to stay. And I had no ration book. Being bombed out would explain that. Well, I could perhaps use that story to learn what was available here. First, however, I needed something to eat, so I went in the railway buffet. I was able to get a cup of tea, beans on toast and a piece of apple pudding with custard. Not very good, but good enough, and I ate it all. After I'd eaten, it was 12:30. I came out of the station to try to see where I might go, and spotted a policeman. Someone doing a bunk might normally avoid the police, but I thought that I might as well live out the story I was telling. If I got caught, so be it, but somehow I figured my chances were at least even money. I had real documents, not fake ones, and the identity card application had Lavinia as a witness who claimed to know me. Excuse me, but I need to find out where I can get information on somewhere to stay and where to find a job. I was in a bombing in December and again last night, where my room and my employer's place was destroyed. Things were so bad in London with lots of people needing help, I thought I'd get away and try my luck somewhere else. The policeman's eyes widened. And you're hurt, miss. Bits of debris from a parachute mine. Mainly grazed, like my hand. I held it up, as it didn't have a bandage, and probably my cheek didn't actually need one either, but it did help disguise me. Well, miss, my guess is that either the WVS or St. James Women's Institute are your best bets. He lowered his voice, then said, if you ask me, the Institute women are a lot more friendly. Not all uniforms and protocol, if you know what I mean. Am I wrong, or is that all you have? He nodded to my pillowcase. Yes, and some of this is from the odds and ends pile at a rest center last night. But I was lucky enough to have my documents and some money with me, but my ration book was with the people who I was just going to start working for and who offered me a bed until I could find something, so it's been blown to kingdom come. Unfortunately, so were they. I took out a handkerchief from my trouser pocket and pretended to wipe my eyes. I heard it was bad last night in London. Anyway, why not get down the church now? There's a shortcut, but the easiest way is Kingston Road to the crossroads with Staplegrove Road and North Street. Then North Street to St. James Street. Thank you, Constable. Not at all, miss. Good luck to you. And worst case, don't sleep rough, but come to the police station and we'll help you find somewhere to doss and give you a cuppa. Someone should be able to direct you there. It was about a mile to St. James. I thought of going in the church, then saw the church hall and found the door unlocked. I rather timidly put my head round the door, but there was a sort of vestibule, so I went in then and put my head round the next door and saw a few women sorting some clothes and other household items. "Can we help you?" said a large middle-aged woman. The policeman outside the train station said I might be able to get some information here so I could find accommodation and possibly work. I was almost killed by a bomb in late December, then last night my new place of employment where I was supposed to start Monday, an ironmongery, was bombed too, and they were putting me up for a few days. So my employers and my place to stay both went up. The shelter I was in took some damage too. Things were so frantic at the rest center in London, I thought I'd try starting over somewhere else, and I was told that some distant family lived here, though I only know their last name is the same as mine, Smith, which isn't really that helpful. I was babbling a bit, but I thought that was appropriate to my story. And you're injured too. Better come in and sit down. We're still trying to figure out what we can do to help folk, but you'll at least be safe here, and we can probably find a place you can kip for the night. And the labor exchange will be open tomorrow. I just hope they don't insist I stay as a sales girl. I'm hoping to do something outdoors. Even join the land army. My neighbor and I had a victory garden until... The large lady who had greeted me said, "My word. Sometimes things work in funny ways. My sister has a small holding. Grows vegetables and does some hens for eggs and a few rabbits. Her husband joined up and she's going spare trying to keep things together, and because her place isn't considered a full farm, she's probably been put low down the list for a land girl. But I think she could hire you, and you'd likely be exempt from the call-up. I was supposed to register last month, but things have been pretty chaotic for me since the new year. I hope I don't get into trouble for that, but I'm eager to do my bit." Perhaps I was laying on the icing a bit thick here, but I thought my character would say something like that. "Why don't you come with me after we finish here and we'll go see Mabel and find out if the two of you might be able to help each other out? I'm Maud Brown, by the way." Wonderful, I said. And I'm Mary Smith. But can I help you ladies here? My injuries aren't that bad. You can see my hand. Debris from a parachute mine blast, I think. And perhaps I should take off the sticky plaster they put on at the rest center. It'll heal faster. I think they thought it looked bad, but it's more grazed than cut. Jackie, Mrs. Hazelton here, used to be a nurse in the Great War. Let her take a look. Mrs. Hazelton said, come down the lav, dear. We'll be able to make sure it's clean there and wash hands before touching the wound. As I suspected, my cheek had been peppered with some debris, probably broken brick or masonry. Jackie, as she insisted I call her, used a wet handkerchief to gently remove a few bits of dirt that remained, and my cheek looked like it had had a fight with a tarmac road, but otherwise wasn't too bad. I used the toilet before rejoining the ladies and helping them to sort what turned out to be donated things. Maud grabbed one item, a skirt, and asked if I had any skirts. No. I don't. When the air raid siren went, I put on two pairs of trousers. Men's, actually. Then go try this on, smart-like. I returned to the lavatory and found the skirt plain but serviceable, but I put my outer trousers back on for now, as the buttons on the waistband of the skirt could use a bit of adjustment for my measurements. Returning to the hall, I said it fits, but I'll need to move the buttons a little. One thing I did have with me was my needle and thread. I keep it in my handbag. Smart girl, said one of the other women. I could feel a gentle warmth of sisterhood in this group. Maybe I'd join them if I got settled here. Part 007. Maud took me to her home, which was on the outskirts of the town. She introduced me to her husband, George, who was working in the garden, a very nice garden too, but being turned to vegetables now. However, we didn't stop. The call at Maud's house was to inform George that Maud was taking me to Mabel's farm. Actually, farm was a bit of an exaggeration, since she had only 15 acres, but as we came to the house, it was clear that all the land was being used to produce food. Maud knocked and the door was answered by a woman whose build was very different from that of her sister. Maud was a large, bosomy woman of middle years. Mabel was thin and wiry, and probably still in her 30s. Maud. Didn't expect to see you today. Thought the knock was someone begging for some eggs or such. Mabel, this is Mary Smith. She's twice been bombed out in London, including last night, as you can see from her injuries. So she thought she'd try here in Taunton and she's looking for a job, preferably doing something outdoors. I thought of you, since you've been struggling to cope with the farm since Peter left for the army. Well, Mary Smith, you'd better come in and we'll see if we suit each other. In case Maud didn't tell you, the family name is Gaffney. We entered into a low-ceilinged kitchen, quite large, and Mabel motioned us to chairs around a generously sized table and set out some teacups. Ah! Another cuppa! There was a big cast-iron range but also a gas stove, and it was the latter that was used for the tea kettle. Perhaps tell your story again, Mary, Maud suggested. I was getting good at it now, and made sure I didn't get any contradictions. After I finished my short exposition concerning Mary Smith and her predicament, Mabel said. I could certainly use help. I've asked for a land girl, but the ministry people aren't quite sure how to categorize my operation, though we produce quite a lot of food, and have done for some years. With Peter gone, he fortunately missed Dunkirk, but they've got him training or serving somewhere. I really can't cope. Oliver is just 12 and he's quite helpful. But he's not big enough for some jobs. Delia is only 10. She's good with collecting the eggs and feeding the chickens. In fact, she does all of that. And Oliver handles all the rabbits and quite a bit of the general chores, so I can't complain about them. But they did those things when Peter was here. We tried to get a local man to help, but he left. So I'm actually quite glad to give you a try. Would you pay at least what the land army pays? I knew that the official rate had been 28 shillings per week, of which half would be deducted for room and board. This was low, and 10 shillings less than for men. On March 1, the rate had gone up to 32 shillings, and there was overtime after 48 hours per week. Mabel said, I can certainly pay the official 16 shillings plus room and board. And assuming we get on and you work the same hours I do, which varies a bit because of what we do, then I could probably suggest a pound if we ignored the fiddle with working out the overtime. To be honest, some weeks it's a lot more than 48 hours, especially when we have product to harvest, but a lot of the year we're mainly watching things grow and trying to keep the birds off. Why don't we try 4 weeks and make sure we work well together? I suggested. I think I could like it here very much, but I've not had much sleep for a couple of nights, so my mind isn't very sharp just now. All right. That's sensible. Is that all you have? Mabel asked, nodding at the pillowcase. Yes. I'll need a bit of time tomorrow to get a new ration card. Mine went up with the ironmongers. And I've really only the clothes on my back. Fortunately, I was wearing 2 pairs of trousers to keep warm. As I said this, I realized I was starting to believe my own fabricated story. Well, it seemed to be believed by those to whom I'd told it so far, and I knew that my telling it with confidence was a big part of being believed. Part 008. Maud took her leave to attend to Sunday tea. It was now about 4:30. Mabel said we'd better figure out where to put you. There's a box room in addition to the 3 bedrooms, so we should be able to fit you in. For now, I just need a place to sleep. Mabel and I moved things around in the box room, stacking some old cardboard boxes in a corner and uncovering a cot. I'll get some linen and blankets, Mabel said. While she was gone, I realized that there was a small window and it looked out over the plots of different crops Mabel had seeded. 2 children were walking up a path. As Mabel came back into the room, I said, "Are these your 2? Indeed they are. They went out foraging for sorrel and mallow, but I think really to look for birds' nests. I've told Oliver he mustn't disturb the birds. Some boys collect the eggs. We need the birds that eat insects. I suppose those who eat the crops he could annoy, but birds like crows are pretty hard to get at." We went down and I was introduced. "Call me Mary," I said. I didn't want to be Miss Smith. Besides, using Mary would focus on that name, not Joan. Mabel added a couple of spuds and some bits and pieces to the pot on the stove. "Hope you like rabbit stew. We eat quite a lot of rabbit, as well as some chicken, but the latter is the tired-out hens, so also stewed. Not much good meat on them by the time they're no longer laying. Daddy used to kill the rabbits," Delia said, "but now Mommy does it, and she always makes a face." "It's not my favorite job, I'll agree," Mabel said. "And I'll strongly advise against letting any of the beasts become pets. We do have a couple of cats, if they'll deign to favor us with their presence. And there's Reggie, a Labrador setter mix." "Oliver, where is Reggie? Didn't he go with you?" Oliver said yes, but he turned back after 20 minutes. "I'll whistle for him." This he did, and there was a bark and a rather motley-looking dog came in and trotted up to sniff me, then went and curled up on a rough piece of sacking near the range. Mabel said, "Looks like he thinks you're okay. Where was he, Ollie?" "Lying down watching the hens. He does that. Considers them his hens. That's why he got upset the other night when a fox came sniffing round." "Yes. Now it's getting warmer, maybe we'll leave him out in his kennel at night. We don't want the fox getting fat and ruining our egg production." I asked, "Perhaps Delia can show me where the lavatory is. I'm afraid tea leads to P," said Oliver. "That's not nice, Oliver," his mother said, "even if it is technically correct. Delia, show Mary where the lav is, please. By the way, we take baths in the kitchen here. Indeed, I saw a tin tub on the wall. The range clearly ran on coal. Good. I could see a tap on the side, so it had a way to heat water. But the sink had just a cold tap. In winter, we'd probably stay a bit less clean. Part 009. I enjoyed the rabbit stew. There was plenty of it, and wedges of bread to sop up the gravy. Then a pudding with preserved plums and custard. Not very sweet, sugar was starting to get scarce, but tasty and filling. After tea, I pleaded lack of sleep and asked to be forgiven if I just went to bed. Mabel said I've an old pair of Peter's pajamas. He's not likely to need them soon, if ever. I was saving them just in case, and would turn them to rags if I ran out of those.
Oh, thank you.
That is kind. I've just about nothing. There's not enough hot water for a bath, but I can give you a good-sized jug or bucket. If I'm not mistaken, you probably have all sorts of grit in your hair. Perhaps it would be good to at least give a try at washing it so the pillow doesn't get too dusty.
Oh.
My apologies. That's true, and I'd probably wake up all scratchy too. Yes. That would be wonderful. Mabel said, "Children, I'm going to ask you to go to bed a bit early so Mary can have some privacy here to wash. You can have the light on to read for half an hour in bed as a bit of compensation, but you must have the blackout drawn if you do." "All right, Mommy. Good night, Mary," Delia said, and went off to the lavatory, which was outside the back door. When Delia came back and went upstairs, Oliver followed her lead and went out to the lavatory. They were very well behaved. After they'd gone, Mabel asked, "Do you want me to pour water over your hair, or can you manage?" "It'd be easier if you assist. I'm not bashful. Grew up an orphan." So I stripped to my bra and panties and Mabel got ready to wash my hair. I'd not undressed since before the fire watching. I was bruised around my ribs. While the parachute mine had undoubtedly caused some of the bruises, I knew a couple were down to William. It was a good reminder of why I was here. Mabel said, "You took a bit of a beating with that bomb." I've not undressed since, and somehow hadn't noticed. Perhaps the shock of it all. Mabel, I'm so grateful for the chance to work with you, and I truly hope I can live up to your needs. I hope so too, Mary. It's been lonely without Peter. And worrying that he might be in the path of danger. That, and the responsibility for the children and the farm. That's been more exhausting than the physical work. And that work isn't trivial, as you're going to find out, starting in the morning. Well, I'll be more than ready for my bed tonight, and I'll give my best to the work.
Ooh.
You've something like tar in your hair. I reached up and Mabel was right. I said must have been melted and thrown about by the bomb, maybe some roof tar, or even from the road. You'll have to cut it off. Well, I won't mind. If you cut it short, it'll be easier to wash and won't need rollers, which I don't have, anyway.
Oh. Are you sure?
It looks like you have nice hair. But I did have to put it up each night. Worst case, I have to wait for it to grow out again. So Mabel cut my hair down to a short bob. It made me look different. Good.